Welcome to Shoot Like a Girl, a podcast featuring interviews with extraordinary military women from around the world who push their limits on and off duty. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and this is episode number 37. Today's guest is Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan. A graduate of the Royal Military College of Canada in engineering, she was commissioned into the Canadian Military Engineers in 1990. She has deployed to Bosnia, the Golan Heights, Afghanistan, and more recently, she led the NATO mission in Iraq from November 2019 to November 2020. Lieutenant General Carignan was promoted to her current rank in April of 2021 and appointed as Chief of Professional Conduct and Culture, tasked with tackling the cultural transformation of the Canadian Armed Forces.
Steady, nice and steady. Light! Hill! Cover!
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the
line. Just a rolling down the line.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
So you better get out of my way now.
So you better get out of my way now.
Before I roll all over you.
Before I roll all over you.
Okay, ma'am, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Kate, for having me.
So I always like to start from the very beginning. Where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in a small mining town called Val des Sources. In a typical family, my dad was a police officer and my mom was a school, elementary school teacher.
Okay, did you have any other military members in your family?
No, absolutely not. Zero contact with the military. I think the first time I actually saw a uniform is when they asked me to iron it. So that was my first contact with the military.
Okay, so what sort of planted the seed in your head that you wanted to join the military then if you didn't really have any exposure to it?
Well, I was looking for doing something that mattered. I was looking for something honorable to do. And I think to me, it was simply having heard about the military college. And I thought, like with an engineering program, leadership training, you know, doing some combat engineer stuff as well, that seemed absolutely the way to go for me. So I decided to give it a shot, basically.
Okay. And what was it about combat engineering that interested you?
Well, you know, it's all those videos that you look at, you know, you visit the various booths and you're just shopping around for, you know, the trade. And I think what I liked, I like the army. I like the variety of things that combat engineers do, and I think I just picked that as something that was interesting to me at the time, yeah.
And when you were growing up, were you involved in sort of maybe some more like rough activities or sports or things like that that would be more army-centric?
Yes, I was a bit of a wild kid, running free into forests and, you know, four-wheelers and skidoos and chainsaws and, you know, doing, you know, that sort of work with my father and my siblings. That was all. I've always had a very active life with sports as well, in school and all of that. So I guess that matched my personality as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like all of those activities sort of prepared you very well for a life in the army. So now I read that you joined the military in 1986. So at that time, I can't imagine that there would be many women who are involved in the combat arms. So, you know, did you meet any resistance when you decided to become a combat engineer, and what was that like for you?
I think at the time I grew up in an environment where, you know, I could choose to do whatever I had decided, and I had no expectations that I would be rejected. So I came in with the idea that I would just do the best that I could. And of course, like you meet in school or like you meet in any environment, you'll always meet people who disagree with your choices. But I've always met absolutely fantastic support and allies through this. And these are the folks that I turned to as I worked with different teams and all of that. So I realized after a while that you would always have people who disagree with you or didn't accept the fact that you were there. But I also realized that a lot of people appreciate you as a person and what you contribute to the team as well. So I focused on that aspect of my work.
And going through the military college at that time, what percentage of the students would you say were women?
I think it was about 10%. So it was still, I think women arrived at the military in 1980, I think. So it was still relatively new. But again, I've met friends there who are still friends today. It's been, you know, it's been a fantastic journey overall.
And I've heard that, you know, I'm not in the Army, but I've heard that combat engineering is very physically difficult. And these days we have everything's right at our fingertips. We have these programs online where you can train for certain occupations if you want. But back then, what did you do to physically prepare yourself?
I think the programs were not necessarily adapted to individual. It was, you know, cookie cutter, one size fits all. So what I did is I took the time to work on the aspects that I needed to work on. So of course did a lot of upper body work because that's what was needed the most in my case. So this is what I focused my efforts on, a lot of swimming, a lot of that sort of thing. And then, of course, bringing in friends, so a partner that can train with you, and you can always find somebody somewhere who needs to work on the same type of stuff that you do, so encouraging each other to get better.
So after you finish at the military college, what does your first posting look like after that?
My first posting was in Chilliwack, in fact. So spent 4 years the first 4 years of my career in British Columbia. For me, it was a challenge. 100% Anglophone. I remember being terrified every time the phone rang because I was not fully bilingual, not understanding the story that I was being told on the phone. So, but again, worked through that. I worked through a very difficult deputy at the time, a chief warrant officer who didn't think I should be his boss. I guess the first act that I did coming in was to fire chief warrant officer as a 22-year-old. And looking back at my take on this is, you know, never accept to be disrespected into any shape or form. So this has always been my, you know, my way of doing things. I am, you know, extremely respectful of everybody that works on my teams, regardless of what their roles are. And I expect people the same for me as well.
And so how do you think your subordinates saw you then after you fired this chief warrant officer?
Well, that's the interesting piece because you're a little bit worried that you're not going to be very popular. But that is actually not what happened because, of course, if he was treating me that way, he was treating many other people. So I learned that day that behavior is also happening with many other people, and actually a lot of people were relieved, and we saw a huge improvement in morale after his departure.
Yeah, I found in some instances throughout my career, it's like, as someone, you know, being that way towards women, and people think, oh, maybe they're just misogynistic, but then it's like, well, no, maybe they're just a bully, and they treat everyone that way, and it's unfortunate.
In fact, you're absolutely right. A lot of other men were not being respected by the same individual. So it actually brought a lot of positivity to a very toxic environment prior to that.
After this, when is your first deployment as a new combat engineer?
It was on Golan Heights, so a very typical UN mission with a zone of separation and the Blue Beret and all of that. The Middle East is a fascinating place. I learned so much during that deployment. It has shaped my knowledge of the area to this day. So going to Iraq in 2019, all that I had learned of the culture and the dynamics in that part of the world served me greatly. Not to say that you still need to brush up on your studies and get ready, because of course there's always changes over time, but the foundational knowledge that I got out of the mission, that mission is phenomenal. So absolutely grateful for that fantastic experience.
And were you working with people from other countries there as well?
Yes, so we were sharing the space with Austria, Finland, and Poland.
And what was that like, working with people from other nations for the first time?
Again, great experience. So meeting fantastic individuals and not so fantastic individuals, so a little bit of a range of everything. Again, engaging with partners from other countries, took the opportunity to do activities who were specific to their contingent as well. So the Austrian battalion march and the Wadi patrol with the Finnish soldiers. So get out of your, you know, your comfortable space and then actually reach out to do activities with the other contingents were actually, you know, and again, a great opportunity to learn about them and how they do business.
And what was your main role or occupation during that deployment?
I was the engineer officer for the Canadian contingent. So a troop commander leading a troop of engineers to provide the engineer support to the Canadian contingent.
So after that, you get back to Canada. Where do you go from there?
So then came a posting to Valcartier, so the 5e Regiment du Génie de Combat. So new position, new environment, first time in a brigade. So again, different organization, different environment. So getting used to the new job and yeah. So and again, another opportunity to learn and gain a better understanding of the many different aspects of the engineer world.
Did you feel like you were a little bit more in your comfort zone being back to a French regiment?
Language-wise, yes. But I have to say it's another level of adapting to what's being thrown at you. So different ways of doing business and different tasks, different focus. And at the time, a lot of new mission like were running that's during the 90s. So missions popping up constantly and always having to react and get you ready and then folks ready for various missions. So Bosnia was kickstarting at the time, Timor, East Timor, like Haiti. So a lot of those were running and getting set up. So a very, very dynamic time with the regiment.
Right, and probably lots of really good work experience for you as a young officer to be involved in all of that.
Yes.
And so you went to Bosnia in 2002?
Yes.
And what was your role there?
I was the engineer officer for the multinational division, so now a multinational force out of Banja Luka in Bosnia, working very closely with the Brits and the Netherlands were the three main contingents for that division.
And so as an officer, I know that combat engineer NCMs do the EOD training. So as an officer, is that something you do as well? Do you learn to do that and then sort of move into more of a supervisory role?
So we do. So we all do basic EOD training. And then we can go into the more specialized EOD world. I didn't do that, but I had EOD troops, whether it's in Bosnia or in Afghanistan, working under my command. Mm-hmm. So you have enough knowledge to manage and plan that space to do that. But yeah, some great work being done by our bomb techs.
While you were doing these deployments and working with, you know, the men from maybe other countries, did you ever have any instances with them where maybe they had never worked with a woman before or they were very resistant to doing that? And if so, how did you handle it?
Yeah, so some interesting experiences with my British colleagues and developing abilities to evolve and work and navigate those spaces. They don't have much of a choice. They have to work with you. So I've used different techniques. I've used indifference. I've used, you know, I can be a bit of a bully when I need to be at times. Use a little bit of humor. And so I've mixed, depending on the personalities and the individuals, I've used a little bit of all of that to manage this space. And again, it's all about respect and developing allies around you as well as you do this. So if there is one thing to remember is to not take this on your own shoulder and think that you're alone. There's always people around you that you can reach to if, you know, taking the time to develop those allies around you, and they are there when you call on them to enable you. So, but of course, yes, I met, you know, some tough folks out there, and also letting normal friction work its magic. Sometimes you just need to let things go. Don't fight them until the normal friction pulls you in to enable and contribute and solve the problem. If people are not ready to take your help, then you need to let them, you know, ask you to come forward, and then having much success when doing that.
Do you find, because you've had such a long career and, you know, joining at a time when there weren't many women, and now we still don't have huge numbers, but there are much more than there were. Do you find there was a time that you noticed a definitive shift between like attitudes and sort of personalities and that resistance to having women in those spaces?
I think there still is. I think there is still a lot of work to do in the perception space. Let's face it, like it's been hundreds of years of evolution, of establishing roles and who does what. So that can't be disbanded in people's mindset within 30 years. So we are still facing a lot of barriers in the perception space. Of course, we have a lot of models now coming forward, and then we're starting to see a difference in what can this look like and what's possible. So that makes a difference for all mindsets when that starts to happen, and then it's going to keep evolving and get better over time. But yes, there has been change and progressive change over time, but much more work to do.
And one of the questions that I'm always curious about, because I don't have kids, and I would imagine that that's a very difficult thing to balance, especially like you've done numerous deployments. And then I have heard from some women that, you know, they come back from mat leave, they're sort of ranked behind their peers in that sense, and it's slower to progress. But obviously, I mean, you've been able to climb the ranks. So how do you manage all of this in this career with also being a mother?
And it's often a question that's being asked to women. Like, men are not being asked this question. So eventually when we are asking everybody, like, because balancing life and your professional life is always a challenge. And I would say perfect balance doesn't really exist. It's always deciding what is more important on that day, and then managing your time so that you balance what's more important. So at times you need to leave your family behind, and at times you need to be there. So it's making that call that is important. How do I do that? I have attempted to manage my sense of guilt as mothers, it's always difficult. And then socially, there's a lot of pressure on mothers to be around. But now I think there's a push for families, and it's the work of a full couple. It's not just a work on the mother. So we are starting to see some changes in that space as well, where men needs to be afforded the time as well to spend time with their family, because that's part of what we need to do as parents. Same type of thing also is don't stay alone. You're not alone to do that either. So your partner is there to support, and you should be sharing that space and get some help as well at home for babysitting. You have a plan B, having, you know, that ready. In case you need, you know, some help, additional help, if both you and your partner is away. So it's a lot of preparation to, you know, in case of emergencies.
And do you think that it's necessary for sort of one partner's career to take priority while the other one takes a backseat for the time being?
I don't think it's necessary. I don't see why both partners couldn't have a rewarding and fruitful career. I think we can make this work. If we make the assumption immediately that somebody's got to abandon, then this is what's going to happen. But I think there is definitely room for everybody to self-develop through their family and then via their professional life as well. Don't get me wrong, like, there might be times where you need to slow down at one point and then pick up pace a little bit later. Of course, maternity demands that you be around. So, you know, why not take a little bit of time to do that? And then post, you know, maternity, then you can come back and then keep going. I have found that I've learned a lot from that part of my life as well, that enables me to navigate different spaces as well in my professional life, and vice versa. I bring in a lot of what I learn at work at home. So, you know, I think it's, you know, to me that has been the recipe for happiness. It's not necessarily I'm not looking for a recipe for success. I'm looking for a recipe for happiness.
Right. And it does seem like that's another shift that's happening within the Canadian Forces, is that they're sort of realizing that it is important for people to spend time with family and have that, like you said, that happiness. And it makes sort of a much more efficient worker. You know, if someone's happy at home and they're spending that time with their family, then they're going to show up to work and be in a better headspace than if they're not getting that.
And the model of society was such that there was one of the two partners working while the other one was managing things at home. Very, very definite roles. Well, the model has greatly changed. There's ways to contribute to society and also be good parents. And I think we need to look at it that way.
And so I just want to jump back to your career for the next question, because you did have a very high profile position in Iraq. And many Canadians, I think Afghanistan was so high profile, but a lot of the public didn't really realize that there were troops in Iraq. So what were they doing there, and sort of what was the mission in Iraq?
The mission in Iraq was security sector reform for the Iraqi defense as a whole. So very strategic. How do you manage defense at the national level in a country where the democracy is not very stable? So NATO has been spending time in various parts of the world developing indigenous forces to make sure that they could conduct their own defense. That's the whole point, so that we don't have to do it for them. Mm-hmm. So that was the role, basically, of NATO mission Iraq, was to develop co-develop with the Iraqis the type of defense that they need for their own country.
Okay, and this, about how many Canadians took part in that?
It varied. We had a very, very tough time. I had about 3 weeks of a normal mission, and then the security situation went really, really bad. So we had to evacuate people because the situation was so unstable that we couldn't keep the whole force there. So it varied in time. So probably had close to 300, you know, 250, 300 Canadians there at the start. But then we went down to, you know, 40 and then back up again. But then the pandemic hit us in March of 2020. So again, very, very tough mission to manage, as nothing that was supposed to happen actually happened. So we had to reinvent and reframe the whole mission during my time over there.
What would you say the most important lessons learned for you during that would have been?
The lessons learned is that you have to, you know, do the best you can with the circumstances that are happening to you, because you don't control that part. So control what's within your control, and then the rest you just gotta leave as is and deal with the circumstances that are thrown at you. And it's very hard because as military we are told, you know, very, very early, command and control the situation, you're in charge, and you know your plan is supposed to happen the way you have envisaged it. But this is rarely the case, in fact. We always hit obstacles. We always hit, like, you don't have a vote as to what the enemy is going to decide to do to you. So again, it's been in between, like, redesigning, seizing the opportunity, you know, through some very, very difficult times, basically. Seizing opportunities when you think you have failed.
Have you had times in your career where you have either failed or felt like you failed, and like, how do you mentally bounce back from that and move past it?
When you think you are failing, it's because you are encountering friction and you are encountering obstacle, which is what normal looks like. I think as part of our training and education, we make plans and they're supposed to go as they're supposed to. But when you're dealing with difficult problems, such as defense, such as a mission, there's a lot of things that you actually don't control. So yes, there are many times where I thought I was failing. What I did is I just basically kept going with this, you know, just do the best you can. Just do the best you can. That's all you can do. And in the end, being told that, well, really what we see is pretty good. And so I learned that very, very early. In fact, on training, where I thought I had completely failed my mission, and at the end being told, hey, by the way, it's the first time we're able to succeed for that engineer task. So I think the key point is to readjust, adapt, work through the obstacles and do the best you can within the means that you have available to you.
Yeah, that is a good point. I do think probably a lot of military members with those more alpha personality types are pretty hard on ourselves. So sometimes we think we're failing, but we might not necessarily be failing in the eyes of others. So I think sometimes we have to be a little easier on ourselves.
Well, it's a bit why I chose engineering as well, because I felt that science had the answer to everything. And I always felt like I never knew enough. So I always spent a lot of time researching and, you know, looking at studying. So this is why science was a great place for me. But then as you grow in time with your career, you realize, you know, at one point that those very tactical problems, scientific problems that have a cookie cutter solution, well, this is not how it works in the human realm, and you gotta bring in other methods to deal with the messiness of human problems. And, you know, this is also a reason why I accepted to take on the challenge of conducting culture in the military, because that's a very human challenge to which there is no checklist or recipe. And then we could start from scratch, inventing and creating something completely new.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good segue into this. So can you give me a description of the Chief Professional Conduct and Culture Organization and what the mission is?
So our mission is to unify all the work done in professional conduct and culture. So what does that mean exactly? It's diversity and inclusion. It's discipline, it's ethos, it's ethics, it's the work that the advisory groups do, it's complaint management, it's bringing in external voices and observation to what we are doing so that we can highlight best practices and implement them into the work that we are doing. So we have built an organization very quickly, and then now we keep improving it over time. We're only 2 years old, so the first version was less than perfect, and then every 6 months we keep improving the organization per se, because not only do we need to implement initiatives to make things better, but we also need to build an organization that didn't exist before. So we've been extremely busy over the past 2 years doing both of them.
And within the CAF, what resistance has there been to culture change?
We meet a broad range of people. So like everything else, we have folks who are already there. They understand what needs to be done. They understand the need for change. We also meet the others who don't really understand what the problem is and wanna get there. Increasing their situational awareness and increasing their knowledge is where they are at. And then we have another part where, you know, this is not for them and they probably will never get there. So I would say this is a minority. I would say most people are within the two first categories. So the first thing we did when we launched the organization was to go out and consult with people. So the initial bulk of consultation was over 9,000 people. And then we just kept going. So, and this is what I've done while I was in Esquire Malt as well, is we just keep going with the consultation and the focus groups, and then we tackle different subjects. And it feeds into our priorities and it feeds into the work that we are doing.
In the ideal world, what does the end goal or the end picture look like for this?
The end goal is operational effectiveness. There is thousands of historical examples of why militaries and organizations fail, and it is mostly due to culture. Failure to anticipate, failure to learn, and failure to adapt. So it is all related to making us more efficient in the end and more operationally effective. So we have been very, very successful in operations across the world and in Canada. And it's hiding a lot of inefficiencies. People are still making it happen, but internally between members of the team, we have a lot of inefficiencies and harm caused to our members. So this is where our focus is those internal dynamics. How do we develop leaders who will lead us into the 21st century? It now needs a different leadership style in the 21st century to be successful for what's waiting for us in the future.
I'm going to try to word this properly because it is a controversial topic. But, you know, we do hear people saying, like, it's still the military. You have to have thick skin, maybe. But I might use a different word, like, how do we still build that resilience of people if it seems like certain courses are trying to get, you know, oh, we're not going to stress them as much or do things like yelling at someone, which maybe in the grand scheme of things isn't that much, but it builds just those little things that would help build resilience for if they are in a place like Iraq and the security situation goes downhill and they do need to perform or be in a situation where it's not comfortable.
We have a few beliefs that we have to debunk, and some of them, you mentioned them. So as an example, to build character or to build resilience, I think we say that we need to be tough on people. Not really. This is not what we mean. We need to change that approach. We need to put people into difficult situation and then run them through it. And then so that they can learn, and then when it's time to do it in real time, they're ready, they feel confident, and then they feel confident in their team as well. The belief that you're going to do that through fear is totally false. So all the studies show it. The brain shuts down when fear is in your face. And if that fear is imposed by members of your own team, it's even worse. You can't learn, you can't innovate, and then you're just going to shut down to survive the day. So those techniques that have been used in the past, imagine people have been able to succeed through that, but we are seeing right now, we are seeing a lot of signals that this is a very ineffective way of working as we are harming our people in the process.
So what progress do you think has been made so far when it comes to like the day-to-day experiences of members in the CAF?
What we are hearing from folks and, you know, is that the level of self-awareness has increased. People self-discipline in between themselves. Hey, buddy, this doesn't cut it, or we don't do this, or so we see that, and then we get this feedback from folks as we meet with them and engage with them across Canada. What we tell all the groups that we meet is that culture is not gonna, you know, it's not something that Ottawa is going to order you to do. Like, culture is every single one of us every day. And we have challenged everybody we have been meeting to influence culture positively around them. So this is where they have a great impact, is to those around them every single day. This is where culture is at play. From a CPCC perspective, we bring in a set of tools to enable leaders to get there. We want to develop different leadership style in our leaders. So what we have implemented since last year is a coaching program where commanding officers and chief warrant officers go through a coaching program where, you know, they come in with a lot of experience already. Like, the last thing I need to do is put them in a classroom with PowerPoints. That's not what we want to do. Well, live, as they are working, they can actually work on their behavior throughout the coaching program. And the coaching program is oriented towards the pillars of culture and where we want leaders to work on specific aspects. For example, inclusive behavior, empathy, and that sort of thing.
How do we ratify that requirement of perhaps having these people that can be violent when they need to be, but also balancing that, you know, with the culture change, whereas now it almost seems in certain ways like we're trying to eradicate the warrior culture, but can we have the warrior culture and have the other side of things as well?
Mm-hmm. What we need to understand is the enemy needs to be outside of our teams, not inside. So the way we treat each other every day, that's what constitutes operational effectiveness. Inclusive leaders can absolutely do violence on other human beings when they are asked to do so, if they are ready to do that. So training people to get there is the key. And how the team comes together, this is where we need to work. This is where we have a lot of inefficiencies. As a concrete example, people need to understand why they do things. It increases your effectiveness, in fact, because if you hit an obstacle and the boss is not around, you don't need to ask, you know, don't need to go back. You can take immediate action on the ground because you know why you're doing it. You can reframe what's happening. And situations evolve so rapidly right now on the battlefield that you can't go back up the chain of command to get a very small decision. So if we look Ukrainians right now versus the Russians, you see those two culture completely different. Ukrainians have success because they have a lot of flexibility on the ground to take action without going back four levels above their heads to make the final decision on a tactical thing that the sergeant or the master corporal or the master sailor can take on the ground. So it has a direct impact on your combat efficiency. I would also say that when asking a question is perceived as being disloyal, we see that. Well, why are we doing that, boss? And if the answer is, well, just do as I told you, if this is perceived as being disloyal, we have an issue because it's going to shut down any other very good questions that sometimes the leader has not been thinking about. And, oh my God, I didn't consider that. Yes, do that. And we may have saved the day because somebody asked the uncomfortable question.
Right. What would be the best ways for a leader to build trust with their people and vice versa for the people to have that trust from their leader?
Mm-hmm. Today we had that discussion here with many folks, but leaders are telling us that they need more tools to be more comfortable in the human space. So we give them a lot of technical competencies. They can, you know, they can steer the ship, they can take a hill like any day, no problems. But when it's time to have a difficult conversation because somebody is not performing or somebody needs to be disciplined, some people will choose not to do that because they don't feel they have the skills to have that difficult conversation. And sometimes it's very simple things that need to be tackled because over time they become a real problem if they're not tackled earlier. And this is when you have toxic, you know, environment that starts to, you know, to grow as those difficult conversations are not happening. So that's what the leaders are telling us. We need to be more comfortable in that space. We need social skills, which they feel they don't have right now.
I think that's going to be a difficult one too with the younger generation that's coming up because they spend so much time interacting virtually and on their phones, and sometimes having a face-to-face conversation with someone is a skill that they don't necessarily have.
Oh, but I'm seeing full grown-ups, Generation X folks not wanting to have difficult conversations either. Human beings, regardless of your generation, having a tough conversation is difficult for everybody. It's getting our teams to be comfortable receiving maybe not so great feedback about them, and the person providing the feedback having the tools on how to best navigate that with our folks.
So what would be your message to everyone working within this organization to how they can do their part to make the CAF a better place for current and future serving members?
Mm-hmm. So I always have I always leave a little bit of homework with folks that we meet. Well, the first message is that everybody has a role to play in culture. Everybody has influence on the climate that they generate around them. So that's the first thing. So, you know, when you get up in the morning, basically asking yourself, what am I going to do today to create a positive space around me? And then when you come back at night, you ask yourself, what have I done today to create, you know, that positive, safe environment around me? Everybody has a role to play in that area. The other thing I also ask folks to do is to seek feedback, either from their colleagues or from their subordinates. It's a very difficult thing to do, asking folks to provide us feedback. So what I tell people in position of authority is to start with somebody that you are more comfortable with, and then increase the level of difficulty over time. Give them a couple of weeks. I'd like to hear from you on how I'm doing as a leader. Give me two things I'm doing right, and then give me two things in your view that I should be working on. You give them a little bit of time to think about that, then you sit down with your folks, and then you have that conversation. You're going to achieve a lot of objectives by doing that. One, you're going to have a better idea of your impact on others, because sometimes we don't know. We have no idea. We do our best. I'm fully convinced that everybody is trying to do their best. But you'll have an idea of the impact you have on those around you. Secondly, you're going to train your subordinates on how to provide feedback. If they can get feedback to their bosses, you're training them to provide feedback to their subordinates as well, or to their colleagues. So just that small exercise can do a lot to improve culture, you know, very rapidly. And the last message I have for everyone is that I am absolutely convinced that we're going to get this right because of who we are, and because when we set ourselves to doing something, we can do this because we are the Canadian Armed Forces. And then seeing folks, you know, navigating through, you know, the very tough issues that we are navigating right now, I see people with a lot of courage. I see people with a lot of engagements in getting this right. So I'm absolutely convinced we're going to get there.
And my final question that I ask all of my guests is specific to women. So what advice would you give to women looking to join the military?
I think I would tell them, just do it. Give it a try. This is done by normal people who just, you know, who just work at it. I was not born a soldier. There was nothing in the stars that was written that I would, you know, I would do this for my, you know, as a professional. And I discovered a lot of things, because I never thought I would stay for this long. I said, I'm just going to do my initial service and then I'll go do something else. But as time went, I found, you know, a lot of challenges, a lot of new things to try. So I would say, just don't be intimidated by what you hear or by what you think, you know. Just give it a shot.
I've interviewed, I think you're my 38th guest now, and that's the majority of the answers are for that question, or just do it, just go for it.
So just go for it.
A very common theme. So thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate being here in person and being able to speak with you.
Thank you, Kate. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening. The biggest way to help support this podcast is to leave a rating and review on your Apple Podcasts and Spotify apps. You can also visit my Instagram page at Shoot Like a Girl Podcast to see photos from the guests, keep up to date with the podcast, and find out about any merchandise releases.